It's Thursday, October 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, unease builds over Russian involvement in Syria and plans to fight Islamic State in Iraq.
If we improve the circumstances of these camps, maybe people, the refugees there, won't be so motivated to go to Europe.
The European Union offers Turkey a plan to deal with migrants and refugees. Also ahead, China's impact on corporate earnings concerns investors. Even non-iPhone, iPad, iMac users will find a new movie about Steve Jobs eye-opening. It's all on today's International Edition. Russia's controversial military strikes in Syria took on an ominous tone in the last few days when its fighter jets violated Turkish airspace at least twice. And whether or not the actions were deliberate, analysts say Russia's Syria campaign entails huge risks. We hear more now from VOA's Daniel Sheriff in Moscow.
Russian warships in the Caspian Sea launched their first missiles Wednesday in a week of airstrikes against what it says are terrorist groups in Syria, such as the Islamic State. But Syrian opposition groups, as well as Arab and Western leaders, say Russia is targeting everyone opposed to its ally, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
Well, it's clear that Russia wants, together with its ally Iran, to change the course of the civil war. To actually win the civil war, help the Assad forces and his allies.
Moscow wants the U.S.-led coalition to work with Assad, but the coalition says Assad has lost legitimacy and should be removed from power. Russia's Syria campaign has thrust it back onto the world stage, but some analysts say it could get bogged down in the fighting.
When somebody starts war, he cannot be sure that it will be stopped on his own conditions.
Russia says its fighter jets accidentally violated the airspace of Turkey, a member of the NATO Western Military Alliance. While certainly possible, NATO says the repeated violations and radar locking appeared deliberate.
And these continued violations, though they last several seconds, it's a kind of fly in and fly out thing, are a bit ominous because they could be kind of Russia recording the reaction, maybe thinking what may happen if there's a real confrontation.
Meanwhile, the lack of coordination in the skies over Syria risks a military confrontation between Russia and the West. Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Moscow.
There is a dispute between the Iraqi government and the United States over Russian participation in the battle against Islamic State. That dispute comes as the Iraqi military says it has entered the Anbar province capital of Ramadi and is attempting to advance on the center of the city. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iraqi state TV is reporting government forces have entered the Anbar province capital of Ramadi from its western outskirts after clearing mines and other booby traps laid by Islamic State militants. VOA could not independently confirm the extent of the Iraqi advance. Anbar operations spokesman General Yahya Rasool told the TV the joint operation by Iraqi military, police, tribesmen, and Shiite volunteers was advancing on the center of Ramadi.
فأبناءكم الأبطال في القوات المسلحة ومتطوعي الحج الشعبي والشرطة الاتحادية وأبناء العشائر.
He says Iraqi forces are waging a battle to liberate Ramadi and pursuing their advance toward the city center on several sides, destroying enemy defenses. Islamic State militants are fleeing, he adds, due to the heavy strikes against them. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi insisted during a speech Wednesday that Iraq does not want foreign ground troops to help in the battle against Islamic State and that air operations must be coordinated with the Iraqi military. He denied that security cooperation with Russia had begun. He says cooperation among Iraq, Iran, and Russia probably would not start for at least 3 months. Iraqi military analyst and former Interior Ministry spokesman Abdul Karim Khalaf told State TV the agreement for Russia to join air operations in Iraq has been approved by both Russia and Iraq at the highest levels. The U.S. coordinator of operations against the Islamic State group, General John Allen, met with top Iraqi officials Wednesday in Baghdad to discuss the ongoing conflict. U.S. Ambassador Stuart Jones also met with Iraqi Parliament Speaker Salim Jabouri to discuss an eventual vote by lawmakers to authorize Russian security cooperation with Iraq. The Saudi-owned Arab Daily Al Hayat quoted a U.S. official Wednesday as saying that airstrikes against Islamic State would probably continue if Russia joined the battle, but there would be fewer of them. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
It's time for us to turn to social media, Twitter specifically, and another big story that we are following. We're checking out reactions to President Obama's apology to Doctors Without Borders that came Wednesday following an airstrike in Kunduz in northern Afghanistan, which killed at least 22 patients and staff. Our social media correspondent, Ji Abby Lee, is here in the studio to bring us the latest. Hello, Ji.
Hi, Jim.
Did the president or the White House tweet about the apology?
Not at all. President Obama's last tweet was actually from a week ago and about gun control. And the White House is tweeting a lot today, but they're all about the Workers' Voice Summit, where Mr. Obama was speaking about unions, insurance, and paycheck, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But Joanne Liu, who is the international head of Doctors Without Borders, has been tweeting a lot this week.
What's her Twitter handle, and what is she tweeting about?
She's on Twitter at JoanneLiu_MSF, after the organization's French acronym. And before hearing from President Obama, she tweeted this: "We need answers not just for MSF, but all medical and humanitarian staff helping victims of conflict everywhere. Hashtag independent investigation." Now, that's been retweeted almost 200 times.
I see. And what about after hearing from the president?
Interestingly, she hasn't sent out any original tweet or shared any tweets about the incident, but the content of her statement on the airstrike is making the rounds on the internet. Liu said earlier Wednesday that the airstrike is not just an attack on their hospital, but it was an attack on the Geneva Conventions. And CNN turned that quote into a meme, which is quite popular on Twitter today. Now, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with the Geneva Conventions, it's a series of UN treaties on the treatment of civilians, POWs, and soldiers.
Well, what other tweets can we follow for updates on the issue?
Their main account is at MSF, but if you want live tweets from the organization, there's also at MSF_field, and there are many other accounts for their regional offices, so you can get more tailored information that way. Jim?
Great. Thanks for the analysis, Ji Abby Lee. Follow her on Twitter at Ji Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. The European Union is offering Turkey a plan promising to resettle more migrants and refugees if Ankara establishes new camps and boosts border security efforts to stem the flow of people to Europe from the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia. The plan includes monetary incentives. Meanwhile, several East European countries are cooperating on controlling the flow of people at the borders of the 28-member European Union. Hungary has come under criticism for erecting a razor wire fence on its border with Serbia. Attila Bécsi, an editor of the Budapest online English-language publication DailyNewsHungary.com, told VOA's Victor Beatty he sees the latest EU proposal to Turkey as a positive development.
If we improve the circumstances of these camps, maybe people, the refugees there, won't be so motivated to go to Europe. And that, I think, it's a quite clever move.
Several East European countries are cooperating on controlling the flow of migrants at the external borders of the European Union. It's a program a top Hungarian official said yesterday could set an example for the rest of the 28-nation bloc. The head of the Hungarian Parliament's Foreign Relations Committee said his country is working with the Czech Republic, Poland, and Slovakia to help protect Hungary's border with Croatia, which is also an external border for the EU's passport-free Schengen travel zone.
These countries are the so-called Visegrad Fours, and this is an informal group within the EU, the Central European countries. And the Czech Republic previously supported the Hungarian moves, you know, because we are at the border of the Schengen zone. We are the external border of the European Union. So if we would like to stop this migrant influx, we have to act here.
On Thursday, the Associated Press says the interior ministers of the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Poland will discuss further ways to help Hungary, which has seen over 300,000 people seeking safety arrive this year. The Prime Minister, Mr. Orban, has been among the most vocal in demanding that some sort of action be taken.
Prime Minister Viktor Orban, he is like a so-called hero in Europe today, because many people in Western Europe support this strong stance against migration, because Western European leaders don't really stop this migrant influx. You know, they want to accept more people, take more people, especially German Chancellor Merkel. But most citizens of these European countries don't agree with their leaders. And that's why Mr. Orban is a positive figure today.
He is among those who are concerned that this migration crisis will change the face of Europe. What are you hearing from your fellow Hungarians about the impact of these migrants in Hungary?
This is the most spoken topic today, because people fear the unknown. You know, it's psychology, I think, and they don't know virtually anything about Islamic culture and foreign people. And of course, they see that thousands of people entering Hungary every day. And this is quite shocking for people who don't know this culture. And it's a very intensive topic, I think. And when Mr. Orban says he defends or protects Europe and the European values, they people think there is a problem which has to be solved.
Bécsi says even more serious than the Greek debt issue is the biggest test facing the European Union because of its inability to achieve a common approach to solve it. He says Western Europe is more tolerant of the migrants and refugees given their workforce needs, but Central and Eastern Europe are less welcoming. Investors, meanwhile, have pushed U.S. financial markets up, but there are concerns about China that remain as companies with significant ties to the world's second-largest economy begin to report their quarterly earnings. VOA's Alexis Christophorus joins us from our New York bureau to help sort out the day's trends. Alexis?
Jim, U.S. stocks closed higher, helped by a recovery in healthcare stocks and gains in energy as investors await the beginning of earnings season. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 122 points after rising as much as 173 points, with Boeing contributing the most to the gains. Apple and Nike were the greatest drags on the index. The NASDAQ Composite rose 43 points to 4791, thanks to a jump in biotech stocks, and healthcare was the big winner in the S&P 500 on the day, helping that index come within 5 points of the psychologically key 2000 level. Jim?
Alexis, as you mentioned, it is the season for earnings, that joyous time about to get underway on Wall Street. What are investors expecting?
Well, they're not expecting much. In fact, they're expecting one of the worst earnings season in quite some time. They're looking for a number of multinationals to say that the slowdown in China has hurt the bottom line. We saw shares of Yum Brands stock tumble 19% today after the owner of Pizza Hut and KFC said third quarter profit and sales missed expectations as what it called unexpected headwinds led to disappointing results out of China. Revenue from China represents 52% of Yum's total. Meanwhile, Nu Skin shares plunged 24% after the cosmetics company lowered its third quarter revenue outlook because of disappointing sales in China during August and September, which the company said reflected the economic conditions in the country. Now, next week, Johnson & Johnson reports earnings. China accounted for 7% of that company's revenues over the last 12 months. And at J.P. Morgan Chase, about 3% of revenue comes from China. But the key to China's impact on earnings season could come next Wednesday. That's when Nike holds its investor day. And any hint that greater China slowed since the end of August will not bode well for overall corporate earnings, Jim, or the global stock market.
Not much joy or love in those early earnings figures. We hope things will get better, but we're always happy to hear from Alexis Christophorus from New York. Alexis, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
There's a new film out that looks at the life of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, the mercurial innovator who helped to revolutionize the modern world. And as International Edition's David Byrd reports, this movie features Oscar-winning writer Aaron Sorkin's take on the life of the man who made iPad, iPhone, and iMac part of the language forever.
People often seem to have one of two opinions about Steve Jobs. Either they love him and think he was a genius, or they despise him as an abusive egomaniac. But Oscar winner Aaron Sorkin has walked between these two extremes with his treatment of the script of Steve Jobs.
What if the computer was a beautiful object? Something you want to look at and have in your home? And what if, instead of it being in the right hands, it was in everyone's hands?
We'd be talking about the most tectonic shift in the status quo since...
ever.
Sorkin worked off Walter Isaacson's biography of Jobs, but didn't want to do an episode-by-episode treatment of Jobs' life. He presents the audience with the Apple co-founder in three acts, in 1984, in 1988, and again in 1998. Sorkin says that presenting the story in three acts lets the audience glimpse some of the man behind the public persona.
The whole movie is just three scenes, all of them in real time. Real time, of course, means 30 minutes for you in the audience. It's the same as 30 minutes for a character on screen. And explore these points of conflict that Steve had in his life, and that way you get to know him, and they're all set backstage in the minutes leading up to one of his big product launches.
The first act is when Jobs is about to launch the Apple Macintosh. The second is in 1998, when Jobs has been forced out of Apple and has created a computer that will ultimately fail. The third act is in 1998, with him back at Apple ready to launch the iMac. Oscar nominee Michael Fassbender plays the title role and says that he had no problem with the way Sorkin decided to stage the story.
No, I mean, it was a luxury, a massive luxury, and a necessity, really, to have those 2 weeks in between each act. So we had the 2 weeks, start act one, finished that, took 2 weeks rehearsal, and then same thing for act two, same thing for act three. It was a great help, you know, just in terms of dealing with the volume of lines.
Fassbender says he didn't try to find out too much about Steve Jobs outside of Sorkin's script.
This is not a biopic, it's a dramatization, and I just tried to, you know, honor the script and follow Danny's direction. And just, you know, also, in full respect to Mr. Jobs, you know, honor the man himself.
Director Danny Boyle says he was impressed with Fassbender's characterization and discipline. Boyle says he never saw the actor look at a script or asked for a line. He just inhabited the character.
He's an actor. He's an uncompromising actor, really. So when the studio go, can he be a bit more, can I have a bit more likability in this scene? You're not going to, Michael's not going to listen to that. He is an intensely truthful and uncompromising actor. And there's something very Jobsian about that lack of compromise, that drive to the, you know, to the vision.
Kate Winslet plays Jobs' confidant Joanna Hoffman. Seth Rogen plays Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Jeff Daniels stars as John Sculley, the CEO of Apple from 1983 to 1993. Katherine Waterston plays Chris Ann Brennan, Jobs' high school girlfriend and the mother of his first child. Steve Jobs opens nationwide in U.S. theaters October 23rd. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And I'm sure it won't take that long before you can see the movie on one of your iDevices. You've been listening to International Edition, perhaps on some sort of iDevice. You can always find us at voanews.com, and you can follow us on Twitter, our handle at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter and our engineer, Aydin Utku. You are the listener, and we thank you for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On October 5th, the United States and 11 other Asia-Pacific countries concluded negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman called the TPP an ambitious, high-standard, comprehensive agreement that helps define the rules of the road for the Asia-Pacific region. In addition to the United States, the participating countries are Australia, Brunei Darussalam, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam, a group that is responsible for nearly 40% of the world's economy. For the deal to be implemented, it will have to be approved by the legislatures of all 12 countries. According to the summary statement by the participants, the TPP, among its key features, eliminates or reduces tariff and non-tariff barriers across substantially all trade in goods and services. It facilitates the development of production and supply chains. It promotes innovation, productivity, and competitiveness by addressing new issues, including the development of the digital economy. It includes new elements that seek to ensure that economies at all levels of development and businesses of all sizes can benefit from trade. And it is intended as a platform for regional economic integration and designed to include additional economies across the Asia-Pacific region. President Barack Obama, who has long supported such an agreement, said in a statement that the TPP reflects American values and levels the playing field for American workers and businesses. It includes, he noted, the strongest commitments on labor and the environment of any trade agreement in history, and those commitments are enforceable. It promotes a free and open internet. It strengthens our strategic relationships with our partners and allies in a region that will be vital to the 21st century. In a statement, Secretary of State John Kerry called the TPP historic, also praising its high standards on labor, the environment, intellectual property, and a free and open internet. The TPP, said Secretary Kerry, will provide a near-term boost to the U.S. economy, and it will shape our economic and strategic relationships in the Asia-Pacific region long into the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.